On Life and Times on ABC Radio National this week, the second episode of Paradise Lost. Hello, I'm Sue Clark.
It seemed to be a very wild country. It was sometime, I think, in March that we landed there, and there was wildflowers. I thought they were beautiful, the wildflowers. Up above the tall green grass, the verbenas and the poppies and other wildflowers. I thought they were really lovely. And the orchids on the trees. I used to climb the trees to have a look at the orchids because my mother wouldn't let us pick them. And the wildflowers were beautiful, even in the Montes, the trees. They were flowering trees, and they were lovely. I thought that was very nice, but still the country was looked wild-looking because where the settlement was, it was on just outside a Monte. It was a plain, a big plain out from the Monte, the first settlement. As a child, I thought it was all right, but the thatched houses, they were thatched sides as well as roofs, and I thought they were rather funny houses. But they didn't have a house big enough for our family, so we had to live in a tent for a while until they built a house for us. And they built a two-bedroomed house and then a big living room. And the kitchen was out, the fire was outside, an outfire, log fire, and it was outside. Well, you had to be careful with the thatched roofs because the straw got very dry and they were frightened that they'd catch a light, which we had an outhouse, a thatched outhouse, and it did get on fire one day and burnt down. So my father had to build another one.
Margaret Riley, at 105 years old, remembering her arrival in 1894 to New Australia, an attempt at utopia in the heartland of South America. And she was speaking to Anne Whitehead, who recorded and presented this series for the Social History Unit in 1990. So, after the defeat in the Great Shearers' Strike in Queensland, many disillusioned Australians followed William Lane to Paraguay to build a socialist paradise. Margaret's father, Dennis Hoare, was one of the ones that answered the call, taking his wife Mary and seven children with him. At the time, Margaret was 11 years old. And if what they found was a working man's paradise, it was for working men. It was back-breaking labour, cutting trees in the forest or Monte, creating a settlement in the wilderness. The overwhelming majority of the 400 or so colonists were bachelors, and soon enough, there was trouble in paradise.
The single men had their quarters. There was two or three rooms built together, with the thatched roof and thatched sides, and they had their bunks in there, and they'd all come up to the dining room for their meals. You could get roast meat, corned beef, a stew, steak and kidney, or what they called a sea pie, or anything like that. Different meal, different what you wanted. But then my mother wasn't satisfied with that. She wanted to do her own cooking. So anyway, she did. They had a slaughter yard out there where they kept the fowls and the pigs and everything like that. And they used to slaughter the cattle out there and bring the beef into the settlement.
The Hoare family had followed William Lane halfway round the world, inspired by his notions of a new life of harmony, equality and mateship. They arrived to find a far from harmonious colony. It was already divided into factions, either for or against William Lane. Many felt he was too authoritarian, but Lane felt he knew best.
He was better educated than a lot of them. Very much better educated, because he was a journalist. And I think he thought he was better than a lot of people. And, of course, the people didn't think so, because in those days, a lot of the people wasn't so well educated. But they had common sense. And they knew what they wanted and they knew what to do. And they thought they were just as good as Bill Lane. But I think Bill Lane, of course, this is my opinion, I don't know. Bill Lane, I think, thought he was better. And he wouldn't live with the common people. He lived in this little house. It was a two-bedroomed house and a living room. And it was thatched sides and thatched roof. And he'd lived there. And when he'd come into the settlement and say what he wanted to say and do what he wanted to do, he'd go back to the cottage. And he wouldn't mix with them. As far as I know, he didn't. Because I was only a child and I didn't take much interest in that sort of thing. That was my opinion. He wanted everything to go his way. And I don't think some of the people like, going his way always. They didn't mind going his if he was right. And they thought they'd rather have the board of management and let everything go to them and let them settle what was right and wrong, which I think was right too, because they had their president, they had their deputy, and they had other members, or anyone could be a member, and they could all have their say, which they did. And I thought that was a better way of managing the place too, because it worked out better for us anyway.
One of the issues that polarised the little community was that of racial mixing. William Lane forbade new fraternisation with the locals. He was determined to preserve the colour line, the racial purity of his Anglo-Saxon enclave. To reduce the chance for temptation, he evicted some Guarani villagers who were living on the land granted to the settlement.
And they didn't think he had the right to put a lot of the natives out of their homes. They were settled there and they were quite contented to live there and live their own life.
Matters came to a head when a community general meeting led by Gilbert Casey resolved by a large majority for the election of a board of management. William Lane had been effectively deposed from the chairmanship. His response was to gather his 60 or so supporters around him and walk out to find somewhere to start again.
As a matter of fact, the best thing has happened which could happen. When men refuse your help, refuse your brains, refuse to even carry out a contract, there is only one course open, to close the contract. Send money if you can. We are starting again anyway. A quiet, safe start on bedrock.
When we arrived there, Bill Lane was either on his way back to Australia or in Australia. We didn't see him at all. And while he was away, the men had formed a board of management and elected a president. And Fred Kidd was elected, he was a bootmaker, really. And he was elected the president. And they were doing quite all right with the way they were. When Bill Lane came back, he didn't agree to that. And I think that was caused the split between them. And he went to Cosma, and a few of them went with him. And a few people came out from England there. I didn't know them at all, never seen them. And in fact, I never seen Cosma. But we knew about it. And some of the people used to come over to our settlement and some of our people go over to Cosma. And they were quite friendly, the people. They used to come over to our settlement to play cricket.
Lane and his supporters had established themselves on land 80 kilometres to the south at a place they called Cosme. This community of true believers resolved to hold firm to Lane's charter.
To save needless inquiries, Everybody should understand that Cosme is for English-speaking whites who accept the life marriage, the color line, and teetotalism among their principles, and who realize in their hearts that communism is right.
The original settlement at New Australia was called Las Ovejas, a Spanish name meaning the sheep station, no doubt to remind these pastoral workers of home. At the time of the split, other camps were established because of friction between members and also because, with dwindling numbers, it was good tactics to show that the large government land grant was not going to waste. But young Margaret found many aspects of life more interesting than politics.
Well, we had left Las Vegas and gone to Loma Agua to live because that seemed to be the main settlement at that time. A lot of the people had left Las Vegas and either gone. They had formed another settlement called Tujiragua, and that was right on the edge of the Monte, right in the edge of the Monte. And because the scrub land was better for growing, and they had quite a cultivation there, and maize and mandioca and sweet potatoes and peanuts and other vegetables. They had quite a big cultivation. They'd fenced it in so the horses and the cattle couldn't get in. And they were doing quite well there, and that lasted quite a while. And then they made another settlement called La Novia, and a lot of people went there to live. There was a chap there who had a bagpipe, and he used to play the bagpipes. There was others that played the violin, and we had plenty of music, plenty of amusement, plenty of dancing, and the accordion, of course, and the violin generally played for the dancing. There was quite a lot of that, quite a lot of amusement. And they'd have their spreads. One settlement would have a spread. Everybody would come over to it and go home at daylight. Some of the girls used to catch fire beetles. When they'd click their head, two lights would come on. Then they'd lift their head, and then they'd click their head again, and two lights would come on. They used to get the fire beetles, or a firefly or something, and put it in mosquito net, and put it on their hair. And they used to dance around with that. A lot of the girls did that. The older girls did that. And they amused themselves. They had plenty of amusement. They'd have a concert. Anybody that could play anything, they'd play it. Sing anything, they'd sing. Some of them couldn't sing much, but they'd sing just the same. And do any recite or anything. Anything you could do, you do it. For a child, it was a real good life. It was free and easy. Free and easy, because half the time there was no school. Sometimes somebody would take it into their head to collect the youngsters and start a school and teach them something. Well, that would fall through. Then the kids would run wild again. And there was a family there. Jones was their name. There was a girl and two boys older than us, a good bit older than us, and they were the biggest characters out, and they'd make up to go somewhere for oranges, and they'd come and tell us. We'd all go in the morning. We'd have to go at daylight, start off at daylight. They'd come and call us up, and we'd go. If we couldn't find a bag to take, we'd take the slip off our pillow and get into a row when we came home. And away we'd go. We'd walk miles. We'd go to Gonzalo's. Oh, the sweetest oranges was out there. Of course, we'd go after the sweetest oranges. We walked miles and miles. And it'd be dark when we'd come home and get into trouble for being late, for being gone. Your mother, they wouldn't know where we were. And the locusts used to grow, all great big juicy locusts, used to grow along the creeks, and we used to go hunting for them. So when we didn't get lost, you know. One night I was down at this bank, the band practice, me and my brother, and the mother sent down for us, and we had a track through the grass. The long grass was up over your head, and we were running home, and I was in front of my brother, and I bumped into something, and I said to my brother, "Oh," I said, "that must be one of the calves out." I said, "I bumped into him." And he said, "No, it's not the cows." He said, "It very likely be a wolf." There was a wolf there. They shot him at the priory one night. They shot a wolf there, and they hung him up, and everybody went out to see it. But it wasn't like the wolf in Russia. They didn't travel in packs. They'd travel by themselves. And the fox was there, and the snakes, there was terrible big snakes there, and there was armadillos. They were, you could eat them, and we never ate them, but some of the people did. And there was possums, there was wild cats, and the jaguar. But anyway, we were never frightened of anything. We were never frightened of anything. We used to travel around and go through the Monties and with these Jones boys. They were the biggest characters out. They used to get us, collect us, and away we'd go.
But a lot of the adults were not having such a good time. Squabbling and tensions between the colonists increased, and numbers were constantly reduced as people drifted away.
There was no money coming in. They were clothing wanted. Well, they had sold a lot of cattle and got some money, and they bought some drapery and food stuff and other things that was wanted, and it was put into a store, but there was no money. No, the money was handled by the border management, and no one was paid any money for anything at all, whatever they did. Well, that didn't suit. They got very dissatisfied with it because they were getting short of things, and the men, they liked to have their smokes and do what they wanted to do with a bit of money. And they didn't have it. They could work, but no money coming in.
The bachelors particularly were unhappy with their enforced celibate lifestyle.
As far as I know, none of the men mixed with the native women. Only Gilbert Casey. He was the only one that I knew of. Or they said, I wasn't sure about that, but they said he was living with this native woman, native girl. But whether that was right or not, I don't know. But he was there somewhere around. I never saw him, but my father used to meet him. But I never saw him.
And at last, after 5 years at the settlement, Dennis Hall was persuaded to return to Australia. His wife was worried by the attention the local men were paying to their daughters. Young Margaret was now a blonde and blue-eyed 16-year-old.
I felt a bit sorry about it. It was a free and easy life for us. Although my mother was very pleased. She hated being there, and I suppose we were growing up, and I suppose we would have very likely married into the natives. It's quite likely we would have. And
would it have been a bad thing if you'd married a Paraguayan?
Well, I suppose we'd have lived on the country the same as they did and lived the way they did. I suppose we would, I don't know. It all depends on he'd marry.
I'm the youngest son of James Craig Kennedy, who came here in 1899. I'm now 74 years old. I've lost my English a little. I don't speak it very much in these days.
I was walking with Nigel Kennedy, one of the colony descendants, over the rolling grassland of his cattle estancia. It's on the very site of the first settlement of Las Ovejas. Across the way, in a patch of monte, are the graves of the original colonists, their headstones broken.
I learnt my English from mother and father. And father was a socialist. This was a socialist colony. He came out here when they scattered up on part of them had gone down to form the Colonia Cosme, as it's called, as it was called that time. And the rest stayed here. But they'd split up. I often think why they came out here, to this desert. This was a desert where there was tigers and everything when they came here. Yet it was a desert then.
But hardly a desert, surely. It's so green and beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it was unpopulated. When father and them came here, they say there was tigers yet.
Monkeys? But,
yeah, the monkeys, a lot of animals there was yet when I came, but tigers, they'd gone away. They disappeared.
In the pretty village that was once Nueva Australia and is now renamed Nueva Londres, a red-haired, freckled schoolgirl directed me in Spanish to the home of her grandparents, Ricardo and Dorothy Smith. Mrs. Smith was the daughter of Australian colonists, the Macreens. Ricardo was frail and 93 years of age. He had lost his eyesight and much of his hearing, but his memories of the old days were clear. I was curious whether he remembered my chief informant about life at the colony.
I've interviewed in Australia a lady who grew up here at New Australia. You would probably remember her. She died just recently at 106. Her name was Margaret Hoare.
Hoare? Mm. Yes, Dennis Hoare.
That was her father.
Ah, well, he was here on the colony, old Dennis Hoare. I remember all those old families.
Can you tell me about how you first came here?
How I came here? Well, my father was a naval captain, and he had to resign from the Navy for bad health. And his doctor recommended him to look for a better climate. And he knew a lot about the old Australian colony. In fact, he was one of the subscribers to the cause. But he wasn't a socialist. But he said, give them a chance. They formed this new Australian colony, and there were quite a few families. When we came out here in 1910, there were quite a few families going there. They had an English school and church, but eventually the funds weren't sufficient to keep paying the stipend to the school teacher, so it all fell through, and there was nothing left.
Did they have a hard life when they settled
they
here?
They had a hard life. They were poor for one thing. They had a very hard life.
What did they tell you about the reasons why they came, why they followed William Lane here?
Father was a socialist, and of course that's what he came for.
When the colonists came here, they got a very large grant of land from the government, didn't they?
Yes.
It should have been a very prosperous socialist colony. Why didn't it work?
Because I imagine that socialism will never work.
Never.
It goes against human nature, I think. They were either in favour of Lane or against him. Very people had anything good to say about Lane. They reckoned he was a despot. He wanted to be an autocrat, and that if you just took up a position in against him, he was an enemy for life. He couldn't stand opposition. What he said had to go. That was why they made a division of it and made the two colonies, Cosme and New Australia. No?
After he moved with his followers to Cosme, yeah. Was there much contact between you people at New Australia and the people at Cosme?
In the beginning, yes. But afterwards, the bad communications, they didn't visit each other, hardly any. There were hardly any visits from one colony to the other.
Was there bad feeling with the Cosme people?
Yes.
Does it still linger on today, certain bitter memories?
It doesn't on anymore because it all died off.
On ABC Radio National's Life and Times, you're listening to Paradise Lost, which was recorded and presented by Anne Whitehead in August of 1990. The colony was now split, and William Lane and his 60 faithful followers set up a new colony in Cosme. This colony lasted much longer than New Australia, and it didn't revert to private title until 1910. In part four of Paradise Lost, Anne Whitehead meets up with the Wood brothers, who were in their 80s at the time, at a Cosme Foundation Day reunion, and from there travels deep into the Paraguayan countryside with the younger, energetic Norman.
What does that song mean to you, Uncle Norman?
Sympathetic Australian words. The billabong, the coolabah tree, the jumbuck, and his billy boiling. We always had our billy can when we were out picnicking. And the swag man. Yes, the swag man was the man that went out back shearing sheep. He'd hoist up the swag by the straps and give it to Pat, and he'd say, "Come on, Matilda," hoist it on his shoulder.
That's Norman Wood in Paraguay. He's descended from Australians, and at 90 years of age, he's talking about a country he's never set eyes on.
My mother told me they called their swag Matilda, and they used to bake their Johnny on the coals, which was a damper. They made it with some flour and mortar and salt and put it on the coals to cook. They were Australian, of course, born and bred in Australia. And Dad wouldn't talk to us very much about it, but Billy Lawrence used to come and yarn with him of an evening here around the fire, talking about the sheep stations and where you ever on so-and-so. And, yes, I was there. Did you meet so-and-so? Yes. And they talk about people on that place. How many sheep could you shear in a day? Were you a rouse about? We used to all gather around and listen to them. We didn't interrupt or anything, but it was great fun listening to Billy Lawrence and Dad talking about Australia.
And your father was a friend in Australia of Henry Lawson's, wasn't he?
Well, he knew him. I don't know if he was a friend of his. But I don't remember him telling us anything about him except that Henry Lawson was deaf as a post. He must have been out back in the sheep stations, going around there like they all did with their swags and the billy cans, tucker boxes and so on, tucker bag. I said tucker boxes because the bullock carts on Cosby had their tucker box nailed onto the side.
And your father was a character, wasn't he, in a story written by Henry Lawson?
Well, I think he was. He called him Little Billy Wood.
Little Billy Woods, the Labour's union secretary, had a poetic temperament and more than the average bushman's reverence for higher things. He was the best of married men, with the best of wives and children.
Little Billy Wood, I suppose. Billy Wood is a bit smaller than the general run of Australians. The only thing I know about it, he was smaller than any of his children. We were all about a head taller than he.
William Wood and his wife Lillian had six sons and two daughters. When I first went to Paraguay in 1982, three of the surviving Wood children, Guillermo, otherwise known as Bill, Alex and Norman, came together at Bill's house in the capital, Asunción, to celebrate Cosme Foundation Day. We all sat around a table, sipping tea and eating brownie cake.
87 years ago today, Bill got here with his mother and father to Cosme, to Paraguay. Well, they were in Paraguay before, but they got to Cosme on the 12th of May, 1895. The Cosme colony was founded, actually, in 1894. And men from New Australia went to Cosme to clear the jungle and make houses and prepare for the colonists to get there. And they didn't get there till late in 1894, but the Cosme was founded by the axemen and the people that were cleaning and making houses. So when Bill and his people got to Cosme, they found it had been already 1 year established, 1895. He was 8 months old, baby in arms.
Every year they celebrated the 12th of May on Cosme by having a general holiday for everybody. They knocked off work and had some little celebration up in the social hall. I may have given the wrong impression that Cosme was waiting for me to arrive to be founded, but it wasn't so. As Ack says, there's people sent ahead to clear the scrub and get the timber out and prepare for making houses, and had a few huts already. There weren't so many made because the ones that arrived when I arrived, they had to have lean-tos, and Mum and Dad went into a tent beside a little island Monte. But it's marvellous, as I say, the Queenslanders, they must be wonderful workers, or they were in that time, to build all they did for the quite a large group of people who went there.
So this day is doubly significant for the Wood family. Do you do any special thing on this day every year?
We have a cup of tea if two or three are gathered.
On Cosme, it wasn't the accustomed thing to drink at all. We young fellows, when there was a dance up in the hall, we'd take along a few litres of Canya, but at Mum's birthday, she didn't drink, and we weren't interested in it either, so it was pretty dry. But there was plenty of lemonade and gerba mate for cedo.
Did the strict teetotalism continue long after the departure of William Lane?
Strict teetotalism, no. After the breakup on Cosme, there was no more teetotalism.
That was one of the things that broke it up?
Yes. Well, no. What broke it up, I suppose, would be fighting among themselves. Couldn't agree to this or couldn't agree to that. I understand.
How are we?
Hello.
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 How do you do?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
John Norman.
How's
Hello.
Leonardo? How are you? Norman Wood. Come and have a seat.
We've got three brothers here today. In a row, it's Don Guillermo.
Bill, old Bill.
Bill.
I don't see why he should be Alec and I Guillermo. Born Surrey Hills, Sydney, 1894, on September the 5th.
And next is...
I'll be Alex. 85, Alec Ack, they call me. Alex, quite a lot of names. But I'll be 85 in July, 17th of July, this year. Bill will be 88 in September.
Yes.
Hearts of oak.
And Norman.
And next.
I'll be 83. Norman. I'll be 83 in July. Norman James.
Just a youngster.
Yeah.
And the next one after you three in age.
Wallace
on Cosme, who will be meeting at the weekend.
He's in August, the 12th of August, the glorious 12th. In England. That's when they shoot the partridges and the other birds. After Wallace comes Rose.
Wallace will be
81.
Saloon. It's not much to crow about, though, is it?
Why?
Well, the Wood family arrived on Cosme. They would have been members of Parliament in Australia. Huh? Well, didn't they say so?
You would have been one anyway.
We might have been killed in Gallipoli if we'd been in Australia.
Well, Don Guillermo almost was, wasn't he? He was still at Gallipoli.
Shame, I say, that I told you that my great pal Mould, who went across with me, when we arrived at Anzac, he said, "My God, that Australian there looked just like you." And I looked at this Australian. He was had been sunburned very badly, apparently, in Egypt. And he had a very bright red face, and he didn't look very handsome. So I didn't bother going introducing myself and inquiring who he was. But it may have been one of my relations. After all these years without much contact with Australia, we still are quite proud of being Australians.
Next morning, we were off on a journey to Cosme, deep in the Paraguayan countryside. Bill didn't come, afraid that the Piripo River might be up and we'd have to ride mules across. And at 88, he thought this might just be beyond him. However, Norman, at 84, thought he was well up to it, so we set off. About 7 hours later, we passed through some thick forest, known as Monte, rattled over a bridge spanning the muddy river, and we were there, Colonia Cosme, a small collection of houses, most of them whitewashed and thatched, around a village green on some high ground. Across the way was the slab timber farmhouse built by William Wood Sr. It looked for all the world like something out of 19th century Australia, which in fact it was. As we commenced our walk around, we were joined by Rod MacLeod, an original colonist who still lives at Cosme, and Norman's childhood friend.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. And how are you?
Would you like to live in this hole here?
It's a very beautiful place.
Yes, well, we love it.
It must have been a terribly hard job clearing the Monty.
Yes. They also had to stump it. Instead of doing like the natives, just cut down the trees and burn off and plant, they wanted to use their plows, so they had to take out all the stumps. It's a pretty hard job. I've done some of it myself. They took out the stumps, piled them up and burnt them all, and then plowed. They planted corn in the beginning and then beans with the corn. And afterwards, they planted sugarcane when they were able to plow. When we saw how the Paraguayans worked it, the last part that they cleared when I was able to understand a bit, they left all the stumps in. They didn't use the plow on that path. But it was only for corn. Those mango trees have lasted, haven't they?
Yeah.
They were there in the beginning when I was...
Millions of them now, but they didn't when they first came here. The Australians. It was about the first day of mango there, the mango tree they brought along. At least they brought the seed.
We still go on down the hill here.
The wind whipped around us as we set off down a slope to what they call the flat, where the settlers put up their first rough dwellings. We were following a dirt track between overhanging trees. Some of them introduced Australian blue gums. But there was pathos in the thought that this was planned as the main boulevard of a great communist city.
There's an orange tree. You can see the oranges on it. There's another one, it seems, in the Monte.
They look good oranges after all this time.
They look to be up high. The man on horseback has pulled off the ones that are lower down. Come on, then. We'll go over to the orange tree. We may find a post or something that belonged to one of the huts they made in the beginning. The social hall was here. We had many a dance here.
Where there's just a grove of oranges now.
Yeah, there's just a grove of oranges. And we had all sorts of people. They used to come out from Casa Pa.
Floor
was a marvelous floor, well planed and waxed.
Handled on it, and I used to slip and fall.
What did the social hall look like?
Well, it was a long...
The first hall was burnt down.
Yes, the first one was burnt down. I don't remember that, but the second one was built afterwards. Shingled roof and pretty well open at the back. They had cross bamboo to let in the air. They had seats, well-made seats for the people. They had a stage where they used to have plays in the audience. We were among them. And I remember a full moon social. They'd make it a full moon social because I suppose there's no lighting. They had lamps, of course, in the hall and in the homes, but in the street it was very useful to have this full moon. I remember Alan MacLeod was tuning up his fiddle one evening, and I went down, and he was playing away the Cock of the North or something like that.
I was dancing around, and they asked me about the moon. I went out and had a look. It's a great big moon, I said. Big as that. And once they got away from me, I was asleep. And I got up and found myself alone at home. But I could hear the music and the thumping on the floor up here. So I got up and came. I went into that little cot where the ladies used to leave their babies. I lay down in that and I went to sleep. And I got up just as the dance was over. When they gave up the colony, they all started taking a drink. And Jimmy Syme was more or less permanently drunk. And Jimmy Syme, he used to yell out to Billy Lawrence, "Next time I'll bring a Jimmy John, Billy." Billy would steal the bottle of Canya he'd brought up the evening before. "What did he say, Billy?" "Oh, nothing," said Billy. His wife was anxious to know what the row was about. And Billy Lawrence, whenever he could steal a drink without his missus seeing him, he'd have a drink. When they went together in the bullock cart to town, he had a little bottle tied under the axle of the cart. And he had an offsider, a little Paraguayan boy. And the boy would ride alongside the cart and look at the wheel. And Billy would say, "What's wrong with it?" And Valentin would say, "I don't know, it looks something to be wrong." And Billy would get off the cart, get under it, have a swig.
Valentin to go under and see how the axle is.
"Get off, Billy," said Mrs. Lawrence. "Now you stay where you are."
Cosby Cemetery used to be down in the flat. My mother was buried down there. That's Adora's baby with that little... There's Mrs. Wood and Mr. Wood, Colin McLeod, old Rodden McLeod. My father was buried over there. I had two stones there, but somebody stole them to sharpen knives on.
Norman, which is your father and mother's graves?
Those two crosses over there.
And there was a funeral service here at the graves?
Well, they have a prayer book. Yeah. And Wallace, I think, read the service, and Rod was alongside him, the only one who understood English. And they did it properly. The only thing now, Wallace said that he needed the thing in Spanish because all the people that come around don't understand English. And now they're burying the native people here also. Who else? Bessie.
Bessie
Tutilla.
My father.
Yeah.
Alan McLeod.
William Wood and Lily Wood. And then we'll have Rod and George and Wallace.
You might turn up to get buried here yet.
I might. I doubt it. My missus won't let me.
So would you say there are a lot of hopes for a new kind of life buried here?
Hopes for a new kind of life? I think they all had a lot of hopes, but it slowly went leaving them. They didn't hope very much in the end. They may have hoped that we would send them a packet of tea now and then, and some help.
That conversation is especially poignant for me, as Norman's words were prophetic. Now his brother Wallace and his old friend Rod MacLeod are buried in that little place. But back then, in 1982, we left the overgrown cemetery and returned to the old Cosme homestead. A pig had been killed for an asado, a Paraguayan barbecue, that evening. Chunks of pork grilled on green saplings over a charcoal pit, and long-horned cattle wandered along the track as we sat outside the old farmhouse under white cedar trees. When Norman Wood was comfortable, with a tot of whiskey in his hand, I put a special request to him. What about waltzing, Matilda?
Once a jolly swagman camping by a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he sat and waited till his billy boy, you'll go a-waltzing, Matilda, with me.
Norman Wood. And you've been listening to Paradise Lost, which was recorded and presented by Anne Whitehead in 1990. And that was episode 3, The Working Man's Paradise, and 4, Virgin Ground. And Norman's father, Little Billy Woods, was featured in 2 Henry Lawson stories, That Pretty Girl in the Army and Send Around the Hat. And you can find them both in a Lawson collection that was published in 1902 called Children of the Bush. And you can, of course, hear this program again, leave a comment, or find more information on Anne's book, Paradise Mislaid, In Search of the Australian Tribe of Paraguay, on our website, abc.net.au/rn/lifeandtimes. Next week, we'll hear the final 2 episodes, A Wild Colonial Childhood, and Paradise, Lost or Regained. That's at the same time on Life and Times with me, Sue Clark, right here on ABC Radio National.
You'll go waltzing, Matilda, with me, and where's the jolly jumbuck you've got in your tucker bag? You'll go waltzing, Matilda, with me. Up jumped the swagman and jumped into that billabong. You'll never take me alive, said he, and his ghost may be heard when you're passing by that billabong. You'll go a-waltzing, Matilda, with me. Waltzing, Matilda, waltzing, Matilda, you'll go waltzing, Matilda, with me. And he may be heard when you're passing by that billabong. You'll go waltzing, Matilda, with me. I'm sorry, I forgot about it.
You're marvellous. You know the words terribly well.